Hello, you're welcome to a special edition of Straight Talk Africa, coming to you live from the School of Communication at American University here in Washington, D.C. I am Shaka Sali, and today we will have a conversation on the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., an international civil rights and human rights icon who had a global vision for justice. Next Tuesday, August 28th, is the 55th anniversary of the March on Washington, a march that resonated with people around the globe, especially in Africa and the African diaspora. Dr. King developed a strong kinship with African leaders who were struggling against European colonial rule. Dr. King believed that the struggle against colonialism, apartheid in South Africa, and racial injustice elsewhere, all were intertwined. Dr. King developed a strong kinship with African leaders who were pursuing independence from colonial rule. Dr. King believed the struggle against colonialism, apartheid, and racial injustice were all intertwined. One of his most famous quotes, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." Joining me to discuss the legacy of the civil rights icon and international human rights leader are Robert Vinson, Associate Professor of History and Africana Studies at the College of William and Mary. He is the author of "The Americans Are Coming: Dreams of African Americans' Liberation in Segregationist South Africa." Dr. Sherry Williams, Assistant Professor, School of Communication, American University here in Washington, D.C., where she teaches classes examining the ways in which race, gender, and class are portrayed in the media. I gather that without Sherry, wouldn't be here this afternoon. So thank you really so much. And I say this from the deepest, better part of the bottom.
I don't want to take responsibility for that. This is a great show and also a very worthy subject for us to discuss. So thank you for being here.
You're most welcome. The Reverend Aniedi Okule, he is the Executive Director, Africa Faith and Justice Network. And last but not least, Faustine Wabwire, Senior Manager for Policy and Advocacy at the Management Sciences for Health. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I have to say frankly that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you on this special edition of Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you for having me.
You're most welcome. Now, I have to come to you really, Robert, because you come from here. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. means a lot of things to you and all of us, of course. But if I were to ask you to talk to me from the deepest, better part of the bottom of your American heart and soul, what really made or makes Dr. King tick?
Well, the first thing we should think about with Dr. King is, first and foremost, he saw himself as a Christian and as a minister, but also a political activist. And his Christianity and his sense of justice came together. He believed that Jesus was the champion of the oppressed, and he made connections between oppressed people in America, African Americans, and oppressed people all over the world, particularly in Africa and the Caribbean, and people of color elsewhere, like in India. So I think what made Dr. King tick was the sense of justice, racially, economically, and in every other forms. He was looking for equity. He was looking to build the beloved community.
Very interesting. What about you, Sherry?
I definitely agree with that assessment, and especially in terms of the beloved community. I think one thing that's really important about the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is that he was serious about making this a reality, not just in terms of these interpersonal communications that we have with one another, but in terms of institutional change. So when you talk about the 55th anniversary of the March on Washington, but it was the March on Washington for jobs and freedom not just to be able to have an opportunity to go where we wanted to go and to spend our money where we wanted to spend it, but also to have the freedom to be able to create our own jobs, to be able to have the kind of, to build the kind of wealth that would also lead to freedom and sustainability for communities of color across the country. So I think it's important to understand and to realize that he was not just wanting us to just come together and hold hands with one another. He really wanted us to be able to stand on an equal plane and equal platform together. And he knew that that had to happen through legislation and policy change.
What about you, Reverend Okule?
Yeah, I think as I look at Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., I see somebody who merged, as he said, Christianity and a sense of social justice. You know, Dr. King was a minister. His interaction with the scriptures, his interaction with the Bible, you know, made him to understand the basic dignity of the human person. It made him to understand that that dignity was not given to the human being by the state or anybody else, but was endowed by God, the Creator. And so anything that deprives a person of that dignity needed to be fought against. And so in that context, he realized that to preserve that dignity, oppressed people have the right to resist so that they can restore that dignity. And so what really made him think was this combination of his Christian faith in terms of the dignity of the human person in addition to the sense of justice. And that made him transcend the U.S., Africa, India, and everywhere where there is injustice and where the human lives are at stake.
What about you, Ms. Wabwide?
Thank you. I think it's virtually impossible, like fellow panelists have said, to ignore the role of faith and how that shaped the person and the revolution that Dr. King continues to be. And I think because of his deep spiritual conviction that all people could share in the wealth of the earth, that all people could work toward a more just and equitable society, I think for him, for me, it was he was responding to a higher calling that, like Reverend Agnetti said, transcended national frontiers. And because of that, it sort of birthed this transnational advocacy for justice, which is why we see his connections with countries across the continent of Africa as they fought for independence. But also, interestingly, to kind of think of how the struggle of independence out there bolstered his own belief in continuing to struggle right here in the U.S.
Very interesting. Robert, you obviously all talk about, you know, his values of Christianity and what have you. But when you look at the man himself and how he lived his life, he was a man, frankly, someone will tell you, had no boundaries, no borders when it came to sectarianism.
Right. I think he grew up in a household, first of all, that was deeply interested in international affairs, particularly African affairs. His father corresponded with African leaders, hosted African students in his house. So he grew up with that sense that there was a world far beyond Atlanta, far beyond the United States. And he took that energy into his domestic civil rights activism. And from the very beginning when he became a minister at Ebenezer Baptist, he was interested in the emerging anti-colonial movement in Africa and Asia and in the Caribbean. So he was making those connections that there were no borders, either religiously or racially or nationally, as we've talked about. So from the very beginning, King was an internationalist. He was a globalist.
And he was a man of justice.
Absolutely.
Now, Shelley, King, the last time I checked, never went to law school. The one who went to law school was Thurgood Marshall. How come King seems to be the man that embraced social economic justice for everybody, for all of us?
I think because he knew how necessary it was. And not only that, I think he really realized how, even though he was, again, based here in the United States and born and raised here and wanted economic, political, and legal justice for people here, he knew that this was still a part of a global fight. So when we think of people in Africa, people throughout the African diaspora, all of us started in Africa. And Africa was subjugated and exploited because of these forces of white supremacy that had an insidious impact on the entire globe, right? So he understood that in order for us to really work on these anti-Black practices that are propagated across the globe, that it was really important to unwind and dismantle all of this through the legal system, because that is where it was codified. So when we think about the laws in South Africa and apartheid, and we think of Jim Crow, that is white supremacy that is codified and embedded into law and made normalized. It was made to be normalized through the law and through policies. And he knew that if we were to really, really have some real justice and progress, not only in this country, but across the globe, we had to change the laws.
Reverend Okule, when we look at Martin Luther King Jr., I was talking to some Africans and they said, the person who probably comes first in their mind is not Martin Luther King Jr., but rather is a one Marcus Garvey. And others, in fact, went to the extent of talking about George Padmore. Others talked about Paul Robeson. Mm-hmm. So why are we talking about MLK?
Yeah, I think if you look at the people you have mentioned, they preceded Martin Luther King Jr. in a way. And they influenced him in some ways. And so prior to Martin Luther King Jr., you had people like Nnamdi Azikiwe, and you had Kwame Nkrumah, who had contacts here. Nnamdi Azikiwe studied at Lincoln University and had contact with Garvey and Du Bois during that time. And so they had brought that struggle back to in the 1950s. As Africans were agitating for independence. So there was this cross-Atlantic interaction between those early African-Americans who were struggling for liberation and early Africans from Kwame Nkrumah to Nnamdi Azikiwe of Nigeria to Arap Moi. And so those first generation of Africans were deeply connected. And so they built They built a transatlantic, you know, communication between them. So that's why some Africans look to that early connections before Martin Luther King Jr. It doesn't mean that Martin Luther King doesn't have an impact, but they try to go to the roots. Where did this begin? What of Du Bois? What of Garvey? What of Paul Robinson? Who, when people were not speaking out, he was able to stand out and speak against what was happening, that at one point the un-American Senate Committee or Congressional Committee declared him anti-American, you know, and even barred him from traveling outside the country. So there were these earlier people who started the struggle, and they were connected, as I said, to the original agitators of decolonization in Africa. So that's probably why you see people going back to them. And even on the inauguration of Ghana's independence in 1957, Martin Luther King had attended it. And then at that independence, Kwame Nkrumah had said that the independence of Ghana would be meaningless unless the entire continent was free, was decolonized. So things like that. And when Nnamdi Azikiwe was inaugurated as the first president of Nigeria, Dr. King had gone as well.
It is interesting that you mentioned, of course, Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois. Others call him Du Bois. What is the best way to pronounce him, really? That giant of a man. He's buried in Ghana. I have been to his grave. His wife is also buried next to him. These were some of the mentors, really, of people like Kwame Nkrumah and Nandi Azikiwe.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Ms. Wabwire, you have a man here who talks about how injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere. Where did he get this from, really? This is a man who grew up during the Jim Crow days. He obviously read about apartheid in South Africa, and he knew there was such a thing as colonialism and all kind of stuff.
Right. I think, like we said from the beginning, Dr. King's calling, I'm not even sure that he understood the extent to which this was going. And so he was driven by this bigger dream and vision and promise for freedom for all people. So whether the injustice was being perpetrated through the Jim Crow laws here in the United States, or the apartheid in South Africa, or the brutal colonial rule that was at the time rife in a lot of African countries, it was impossible for him to contain his struggle within the confines or the boundaries of the United States. And you see that how that has evolved over the years to inspire or kind of add fuel to the Pan-Africanism movement. And I can think of one leader from Burkina Faso who obviously ruled way after Dr. King. But just looking at the interlinkages, the intergenerational influence of all of this thinking, of the dream and the promise. And you mentioned the March on Washington. While Dr. King championed the Poor People's Campaign, I think of Mr. Sankara in Burkina Faso leading this revolution against French colonial rule, not just in his country, but within the African countries around there. And they're very similar in many ways. They are not identical, but they are very related. On one hand, Dr. King is fighting against, you know, oppression and homelessness and poverty in the United States. And a few years later, after Dr. King is assassinated, Thomas Sankara is leading that revolution in Burkina Faso and leading a campaign very similar to the Poor People's Campaign in his national context, calling about self-determination and raising people out of poverty and giving rights and freedoms to women to champion the cause for justice in their countries.
You know, Ms. Wabwire, you mentioned, of course, this important march in Washington. Was it 1963, somewhere around that? Mm-hmm. You come from Kenya. Aren't you proud of the fact that a Kenyan by the name of the late Tom Mboya mm-hmm. actually had the opportunity to address the rally?
It's one of those things that I think we all ought to constantly read and remind ourselves. And I think, just like President Obama keeps saying, it's not enough to stand on the accomplishments of those who've gone before us, but keep the dream alive, live the promise, and seize the opportunity to change the world, remake history. And so just like Tom Mboya, a fellow statesperson from Kenya, obviously, of course, great pride in that, and to all of us here, because the struggle, as we are saying, was global. And so obviously the fruits should be celebrated by all of us, but even more importantly, where we stand today and what we do with what we have been entrusted to us.
Very interesting. Robert, you know, this great man once observed that in the end, we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. What did he exactly mean by that?
Well, there's much to say to that. But I want to piggyback very quickly on what our panelists have said. That 1963 moment, the March on Washington, is such an important moment because every year on that anniversary, we get the same soundbite, right, about I have a dream, I have a dream. And it makes King seem to be a type of moderate, sort of out of touch. He's dreaming, right? But as our panelists have said, Sherry said, that march was for freedom, justice, jobs, concrete demands. And the fact that Tom Mboya is there, a Kenyan, addressing this, and at that march, it's announced that W.B. Du Bois, some would say the father of Pan-Africanism, died the night before. Those connections between Kenya and Ghana and the United States speaks to this black freedom struggle that was global from the beginning. So when black people came to these shores in America, for instance, we came enslaved. From the very moment then when we came to these shores, we were thinking about freedom. So that freedom dream goes from Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, Ida B. Wells, these prominent women, and is connected to these international struggles. And so King needs to be looked at as a militant, as a radical, and deeply connected to internationalist black freedom struggles. And I think that moment in 1963 speaks to that. To your question specifically, he was very clear that evil could exist in the world primarily through the silence of well-meaning, good-natured people who were silent at the moment of crisis. And so it wasn't necessarily the KKK that was the primary enemy, per se. I mean, clearly, they are an enemy, no question about that. But it was that what he would call that silent majority of people who would not stand up and be counted when it came time to battle for freedom. And so that's what Dr. King meant. He wanted folk to get up, stand up, and actually act on the courage of your convictions to change this world, to actually create that beloved community. When he talked about a beloved community, he talked about a world house. And so it is speaking specifically to black demands quite often, but also he's a deep humanist. He's speaking about human rights for all people. And that's a vision that we need now, today, more than ever.
Is it possible that he perhaps realized that Americans, including black Americans, had constitutional rights? They were citizens who had constitutional rights, who owed allegiance to the state. They were not subjects to an individual authority who in turn would grant them privileges.
Well, that's a connection that Dr. King made. You know, the U.S. South was an authoritarian, undemocratic, one-party state ruled by the Democratic Party from the onset of Jim Crow, from the 1890s to the 1960s. Very similar in South Africa, a one-party, undemocratic, authoritarian regime. And so he saw those connections very clearly, that one must fight always for democracy, for full freedom, right? And make those connections to move toward racial justice.
Shirley, Dr. King, before he was assassinated, he talked about how he had a dream that one day he hoped that his children would not be judged by the color of their skin, but rather by the content of their character. Has that been realized so far, in your view?
In my view, I would say, unfortunately, no, it has not been realized. But I do think it's important for us to underscore and highlight the progress that has been made in the past 50 years, and really the progress that has been continued to be made by not only people who were in King's camp, but other freedom-loving people who have really and seriously dedicated their lives and work toward the liberation of black people and people across the globe. But no, I think we can look to any number of examples here in the United States and see that that dream has not been realized, especially we can particularly in these last 4 years point to anti-black state violence that we've seen that has been revealed by mobile phones and social media. We've seen a lot of deaths and killings of people concentrate on the deaths of black men, but there's been a lot of police brutality against black women, and including sexual misconduct behind bars while women are incarcerated. I mean, there are a myriad of problems that still exist. Unemployment, lack of education, lack of access to education, even voting rights. We're coming up on the anniversary of Equality Day, in which we celebrate when women got the right to vote in 1920 with the 19th Amendment. But we know that for women of color, not just black women, but for Asian women, for Latinas, there were still hurdles because Asian people still had problems even trying to become citizens in this country, so that automatically automatically just barred them from having the right to vote. So when we say, is the dream still alive? Yes, it is. But has the dream been fulfilled? Absolutely not.
What about you, Reverend Okule? He was a drum major of justice. He was a son, a descendant of Africa, who stood on the top of the mountain as tall, probably as Kilimanjaro, and said, you know what? Africa needs really to be treated fairly. He was on the side of those people who obviously were struggling against colonialism. Colonialism has ended, and yet there seems to be no justice on the African continent, at least most of it. Why?
That's a very intriguing question. It could be a whole event by itself. Why? I think that when we look at the entire continent, and then in the context of what we are talking about here, justice, in the context of the dignity of the human person, which Martin Luther King was fighting, in the context of human solidarity, in the context that, you know, if we want to achieve something good for all of us, don't concentrate on yourself. Seek the good of all, and then you benefit from it. I think as we look at the current scenario across the continent and the injustice perpetrated this time around, not so much by outsiders, but by leaders who are the conduits of injustice into the continent. What do I mean by that? The basic problem that we see in the continent now is leadership deficit. It's the problem of governance. And so we have people in leadership position who continue in some ways, and even worse, the exploitation of the masses, the exploitation of the people, who think first of themselves and not of the common good, who are able to bring multinational corporations in to exploit the people and get a few thousand dollars in their pockets and look the other way. So the whole issue of fighting for liberation, it is far-fetched, you know, on the continent. We could say that, okay, we achieved independence from colonial rule, but has colonization ended? Absolutely not.
What kind of independence are you talking about? Exactly. Are you talking about what some characterize as
flag
independence?
Changing the flag. changing the flag and changing the color of leaders, you know, in many continents. I mean, if you look at what is happening, some of the African leaders, I don't know how to put this. I would say some of the African leaders are even worse than their colonial masters.
Are they leaders, or are they, as some suggest, probably rulers?
Rulers, yeah. Rulers or dictators or whatever name we call them. Because what is happening, as you look across the continent, even starting with the Central African region, you know, you look at the leaders there, you know, and then you go down south, go down out west. One thing comes across. Those leaders, those rulers, to be exact, those rulers don't care for the common good. And it is really impossible for a country to develop without carrying everybody along, number one. Number two is that if that country doesn't seek the national interest as primary in so many ways, it will not advance. And thirdly, if the country doesn't exploit the talents within the country, you know, it is wasting the human resources of its people. And that is a problem that afflicts the continent in so many ways. The waste of human resources, the waste of natural resources, and the inability or refusal to harness the resources, both human and material resources, for the common good. And so when we look at what is going on, yes, independence, you've changed the flag, but the whole thing continues. And if I may add to that is that if you look at during the colonial era, you had 8 countries colonizing the continent, exploiting it the way they wanted. But now the field has opened much wider. Governments as governments have receded to the background. We have multinational corporations, you know, giving, you know, from agroecology to technology gurus to all of that, exploiting the continent. And we have new players landing. During the colonial era, they were mostly European countries. Now you have China barging in, you have Russia barging in, and
you also had the Ottoman Empire. You had the Ottoman, Turkey.
Yes, you know, that barging in. So you have a lot of colonialists on the continent now than they were 57 years ago when Ghana first achieved independence. And so that has opened another perspective to what is happening, to what the injustice that Martin Luther King was talking about, to the human solidarity and the common good. I repeat that word, the common good, that the rulers are not taking it as part of what their responsibilities are. Mm-hmm. Leaders are supposed to seek the welfare of the people they are leading, and that is absent in most countries.
Ms. Wabwire, you obviously heard the Reverend. He seemed to say that the African rulers, if I might use that word advisedly, have pretty much inherited a certain truck with a specific engine, and the engine has not been changed. So it's more of the same, really. How can you reverse the situation so that these rulers can indeed become leaders who at least are social, economically, and politically sensitive to their people?
Great question. And before I respond specifically to that, I just want to share that when I was growing up in Kenya, before I read any scholarship around Dr. King or any of these Pan-Africanists, there was this constant reinforcement or teaching around our shared humanity, around our interdependence on each other, that I owed my selfhood to the other person, and to the broader context of Ubuntu as we know it, I am because we are,
what
right?
What if I'm not Ubuntu?
Well, you are in this
what
case.
What if I'm like an erotic? Africa is made up of more than Bantu. In fact, some people have suggested what we need is Bantuphone.
Bantuphone, whatever we call it, but the concept, remains for as long
Anglophone.
As we don't lose sight of what this really meant. It's a beautiful thing. And so having said that, I think to Father Anieri's point about where we've gone wrong is really going back to what we've talked about, losing sight of that vision, losing sight of the dream and the promise that all of this revolutionaries kind of handed to us. But you think of the struggle or the goal that Dr. King and all of these other Pan-Africanists stood for as a process. So each one of us has a responsibility. Every generation that comes, it's not an event.
One incident.
And it would be wrong to assume that what they handed to us is where we should stop. And I think that's part of the problem.
Very interesting.
They handed the baton to us, but what have we done with it? And I think that's the challenge, the struggle that we see on the continent today. I will also say that what gives me hope is the future of Africa, which is Africa's youth.
Africa's youth, and probably in tandem with social media.
Great, great combination, powerful force there. And I say this because not only Africa has the youngest population in the world, but what that brings, the promise of that, if we tapped into that right as we should, the energy and the innovation and all of the good things that come with a youthful population, they are demanding good governance in ways that I think the previous generation has failed. They want leaders who see and bring the best in them. They want leaders that honor the social contract they have between the governed and those who govern.
Because they are not invested in the status quo.
Absolutely. And I think that's a beautiful thing to be. It's a good place to be. I mean, these are people who are being born with cell phones and ready to innovate. So the baggage of that colonialism and all of these things that we talk about and bogus down, they are free from that. And I think that's great promise if well tapped into.
That reminds me of, was it the 70s during the Vietnam War, when college students were drafted to go to the front line? Guess what happened on American campuses? They wanted the end of the war. Very interesting. I'm reminded, by the way, that I am being a little bit undemocratic because I am not going to the studio audience. So I think I really have to do that. And for that reason, let's go to the studio and see what kind of questions they have. You have to go behind a microphone. Tell us your name, your affiliation, and of course, your question. And please try to be as succinct as humanly possible.
I'll try, Shaka. Thank you, Shaka, and wonderful panels.
You're most
My name
welcome.
Is Abdi Yabaro. I'm the chief of the VOS Somali service. Somali is the issue, so I will address what I stand for. In we discussed a lot about what Martin Luther King has done, and I would like to address this question to Mrs. Sherry Williams, who said his dreams were not achieved. In my memories, in the African Americans was only allowed to go to even to the booths and participate in election in 1963, if I'm not mistaken. I came to this country in 1981, only maybe 17, 16 years after that. So for the 36, 37 years I have been here, I've seen a lot of change. And it touched me when you talk about that dreams were not being fulfilled. I know that so many has done, but my question is, what do you think was not fulfilled? And how we can achieve the kind of things that you have in mind, and who should be addressed to fulfill those dreams that you think it's lacking.
Thank you very much. What about that, Shelly?
Okay, well, first I just have to say that I think if anyone had the answer to that particular question, that all of us might be in a different social and political situation. So I'm not sure if I have the complete answer to that question, but I do have some ideas. But when you ask what are some of the things that have not been fulfilled, again, I don't mean to sound redundant and repetitive, but like this state-sanctioned violence against Black people, because one of the things that Martin Luther King was totally for the country actually taking a look at and eradicating was the ways in which police were brutally interacting with Black people in particular, but people across the board, because this is someone who was jailed several times throughout his career as an activist and actually saw firsthand what it was like to not actually have encounters with the police, but also to be incarcerated. And then when we fast forward 50 years later, we see that there is actually a system of profit that is built on the exploitation of Black bodies inside of the prison industrial complex. So when we think of what has not been achieved, it's still some of the same old issues that Dr. King and all of his comrades talked about back then. Police brutality, access to jobs, access to voting even, because we see that there were parts of the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that were dismantled. These voter ID laws, closing down early voting, all of these different ways in voter ID, same day voting, registration, all of these ways in which there had been progress for people to have access to voting are now being rolled back. And one of the things that I would like to say, though, because we haven't really talked about this very much, and I totally understand why, because this is a focus on Dr. King, but I also think it's important for us to also realize how he was not just one person doing this work alone. He was doing this work with an alliance of people. people and people who we don't necessarily still recognize and give their just due to now, even including women like not only Rosa Parks, that's a name that a lot of us know, the women like Diane Nash, Amelia Boynton, Ella Baker, Fannie Lou Hamer, a queer black man, Bayard Rustin, who was pretty much the architect of the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. So even
Harry Belafonte.
Harry Belafonte, so many others, but we do recognize me in a lot. That's why I left him out just right now. But we are still working and striving toward rights for women and rights for LGBT people. Dr. King, the last thing that he was working on was the Poor People's Campaign. And when we look at wealth disparities now, just across the board, they have grown vastly and specifically for people of color. So, I mean, there's a lot that still has to be achieved. Now, how we go about doing that, I don't have the answers for that. I don't have the answers, Sway. But at the same time, you asked whose responsibility is it? It's everyone's responsibility, because you talked to, as someone I remember started talking about boycotting. I remember someone saying that a little bit earlier. Oh, no, I think it was an idea that I had. But when you talked about complicity, I'm sorry. I was talked about, I'm really not feeling well today, so I'm kind of all over the place. But you talked about, you asked the question about King saying, like, about people's responsibility and when people should act and, like, it's not the other people not acting, it's your friends being silent. And I think one of the things that we have to all understand is that when you ask whose responsibility is it to work on these issues, it's everyone's responsibility. Because if we're not actively working against dismantling some of these issues, then we are in some ways complicit. So I think that's another thing that we have to realize. So you talk about being complicit. So when there is a company that we know that taps into prison labor that is an extension of the exploitation of black bodies, do you do business with that company? You know, so what stand do you take? I mean, everyone is not going to get out on the front lines and go to a march or lead a rally or, you know, stand and participate in a sit-in or something like that. But there are ways that we can act with our dollars, which I think is also really important, because King was talking about spreading out wealth and making sure that everyone had an opportunity to just have basic access to food, housing, clothing, and education.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but what about Jesse Jackson? Didn't he do a bit of that kind of strategy in Chicago?
He definitely did. Yeah. In Chicago and across the globe.
Very interesting. Let's go to the audience again, please. Let's be a little bit more democratic this time. Any particular question?
Somebody.
Yeah, could you please go behind which microphone?
He's there.
Okay.
He's right there.
Go ahead. Your name and affiliation and, of course, question.
Sure. I'm here on my own behalf, but we've touched on a lot of civil rights leaders that were important in Africa. I'd like to hear just a little bit about Malcolm X, and I'd also like to know who's carrying the baton now and who's the drum major for civil rights and justice.
Thank you very much, Paul Sisko, my man. What about you, Robert? How do you respond to that?
Sure, right. We can't really have a conversation about black freedom struggles and Martin Luther King without Malcolm X, right? And Malcolm X is vitally important to that idea of internationalism. In the last year of his life, for instance, he made three separate trips to Africa, was very interested in Pan-Africanism on the African continent, and actually created an organization based on the Organization of African Unity, his organization, the Organization of Afro-American Unity. And what he wanted to do was use these newly independent African countries, work with them, and work together to bring a case against the United States government, charging them with genocide, with the treatment of black peoples. He wanted to take that case to the United Nations. So here, Malcolm X, deep black nationalist, deep freedom fighter, also a great internationalist. And quite often, Malcolm X is pitted against Martin Luther King as if they are sort of oppositional forces. Mm-hmm. They wanted the same thing. They wanted human rights. They wanted full justice. They had slightly different ways of getting at it. But we often pit them against each other as if they were polar opposites. So I would say just a little bit about that with Malcolm X. Reading Malcolm's last speeches in his last year and reading Martin Luther King, hearing his speeches from his last year, and reading King's last book, Chaos for Community, if you read where Malcolm X and Martin Luther King is in the last year of their lives, they are so ideologically and politically intertwined. And the issues that they were both dealing with, King, chaos or community, racism, poverty, war, those are issues that are still with us today, right? That question about who is the drum major today, moving forward today, I'm going to piggyback on Dr. Williams's answer here. Our concept of leadership has to be beyond looking at the great men. Quite often men, we look at men, although there's so many women engaged in the struggle. It's really all of us. We're all leaders. We all have the capacity to lead. And that's what the civil rights movement was really about. It wasn't just Martin Luther King, right? He was part of a grassroots movement that involved ordinary, everyday men, women, and children who empowered themselves to analyze their situation and come up with solutions to their particular problems. That was leadership. And that inheritance is there for all of us to have.
Talking about women, where would you place the beautiful intellectual Angela Davis?
So there's so much to say here, right? And so we've named some names, so from Sojourner Truth to Harriet Tubman to Ida B. Wells in the 19th century. We've gone forward referencing a number of people in the civil rights movement, Shirley Graham Du Bois, Eslanda Robeson. Angela Davis is in that tradition of fighting for justice, dealing with the problem of mass incarceration. From a very early age, engaging in questions around what's happening, if you read George Jackson's Soledad Brother, for instance. When we look at Angela Davis on the front lines of that, and also herself dealing with the threat of incarceration, being persecuted by the United States government, right? Angela Davis is an important...
California at the time.
Absolutely. That's right. And so Angela Davis is in that model of activist intellectualism, right? Bringing together study, thought, and active engagement, political engagement. So she is part, like Martin Luther King, like Malcolm X, part of that tradition of critical analysis and action fighting for freedom.
Robert, what about the great artist, activist, Pan-Africanist, and lawyer? He did his law degree at Columbia Law School. I'm talking about Paul Robeson.
Right. Again, so we're in this moment now. For Paul Robeson was many things, as you mentioned. One other thing he was an athlete. He was a football player, All-American football player at Rutgers. And while he was a lawyer, an activist, an artist, he stands also in a tradition of black athletes engaging in social justice activity. And this is a particularly important moment now when we're looking at NFL players, NBA players engaged in political activism, using that platform to address issues of social injustice. That these athletes today are standing on the legacy of people like Paul Robeson, who used his fame, his fortune, his platform to speak out against all forms of racial injustice in America, in Africa, and around the world. And he paid a heavy price for it. His passport was revoked. He couldn't travel overseas.
As a matter of fact, he was denied to attend the Ghana independence.
Absolutely, right? And so we have a moment here where we have to consider folk who had the courage of the convictions and lost everything and still carried on. Here I Stand, his memoir, speaks to that, that tradition of struggle and sacrifice. It's also important to talk about Du Bois and why he died in Ghana, because he was so disgusted with how he was treated in this country. Here's a person who was a leader in the civil rights movement and the Pan-African movement, and by the 1950s was so persecuted, also denied a passport, right, that he left the country, renounced U.S. citizenship, and lived the rest of his life in Ghana, found refuge on the African continent. Right, so that's a tradition of folks sacrificing, real sacrifices. That's a legacy that we can take and use in our own lives today.
Paul Robeson, by the way, was also not only a colleague but a mentor to many of Africa's founding leaders, including yours truly, Jomo Kenyatta of Kenya, Kwame Nkrumah, Leopold Sedar Senghor of Senegal, and all those kind of people. Very interesting. You know, this is a question that I will ask the panel, and whoever thinks that he can hit it go for it. We talk about Martin Luther King Jr. We talk about a lot of things and stuff like that. But it is quite possible that there are certain things that people probably don't know about him. What would that be, for example?
Well, I'll jump in for a second. I think people know this, but I don't think people realize how masterful he was in his use of mass media. Because thinking of historically where not only the nation was, but also where media was, and also how the mainstream media and how the country as a whole viewed black people, he was able to craft his activism in a way to tap into this emerging medium of television and help to create some images that really showed injustice and subjugation and just how rabid racism was in action. In these live pictures that were not only just distributed across this country, but that were distributed across the globe. So the ways in which he was able to tap Diane Nash to be a public relations person, right? Because, I mean, whoever heard of a public information officer back then? But he had that foresight to actually create media strategies and tap into the mass media so that he could be able, not alone, again, not alone and solely, but to be able to spread this message, not only the message of liberation, not only just across the country, but across the globe.
What about information that Harry Belafonte actually did buy him life insurance without his knowledge?
Yeah. Well, I think that, yeah, that is information that people probably don't know, but I think it also spoke to the daily threats of violence that he and others in the movement faced that people today probably don't realize just how insidious it was. Because I went to college in Jackson, Mississippi, Jackson State University, and one which it's a landmark now, but we think of Medgar Evers just going home and being killed in his own driveway. With his babies asleep in the house with his wife. So just this real, just constant threat of very real and vicious violence is something that I don't think that we necessarily keep in mind today.
Right. I think he was exhausted at the end of his life. And partially because we don't realize this, but he was deeply unpopular throughout America at the time of his death. And there were many, even in the civil rights movement, who felt that his very courageous stand against the Vietnam War was strategically the wrong play against the president, Lyndon Johnson, who had helped pass the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act. So even with, and there were younger people using the language of black power, questioning nonviolent tactics alone. And so he was under pressure from all sides, but particularly dealing with death threats constantly. The exhaustion of being an activist over a long period of time, I think, is underappreciated. The type of pressure that not just him, but his whole family and many other activists are dealing with, the threat of death at any moment, right? I think that's extraordinarily important to remember about King, that he was deeply unpopular toward the end of his life. Even as we celebrate him now, we forget why he was unpopular, because he continued to take those courageous stands.
What about the man that Eleanor Roosevelt, the first lady, of course, wife to FDR, used to refer as Mr. United Nations, Ralph Bunche?
So Ralph Bunche, of course, Nobel Peace Prize winner, and Dr. King was also a Nobel Peace Prize winner. I think where Bunche and King might have some interplay is on the international forum. And I'll mention just this one part with South Africa. King understood the difficulties of working nonviolent strategies in South Africa. He looked at South Africa as even a worse case of institutionalized white supremacy than the United States. And his idea was thinking creatively about international nonviolence, economic sanctions, diplomatic isolation of the South African regime, bringing them to the negotiating table, combined with domestic mass organization within South Africa. that sort of creative way of thinking about the United Nations, for instance, and thinking about what he called international nonviolence put pressure against the South African regime, eventually proved to be rather effective in the 1980s. So I think in those ways, Bunch and King might have some symmetry on the international stage.
Very interesting. What about, you talked about, of course, Malcolm X, the man who was called, was it Detroit Red? With the zoot suit. What about the author of the autobiography of Malcolm X? I'm talking about Alex Haley. I'm talking about Alex Haley.
Someone's calling with an answer to that.
Really? A man who, of course, is probably better known for Roots. And I know him, even for me personally, I like him because he once said, that find something good in someone and praise it.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you mentioned Alex Haley, yes. You can talk about Alex. I remember as a young boy looking at Roots and having some understanding in that miniseries how that was must-see TV, and bringing that in touch with some aspects of slavery and emancipation in our country. But when you mentioned Malcolm X, I immediately thought about Detroit Red.
Yes.
And the fact that Malcolm X was incarcerated for several years. And when we're talking about this era of mass incarceration, Malcolm X, that example of his prison time and how he used that prison time and how he came out of prison so deeply politically conscious, it makes me think about how many young women and men incarcerated now could be Malcolm X.
Very interesting.
Right?
Let's be a little bit more inclusive. Let's go to the audience.
Yes, hi. My name is Laura. I'm a French-American citizen and social entrepreneur based in Haiti. My question is, so in the U.S. in the 60s, in the history and today, a lot of the violence is state violence, for example, the police against the people or citizens against other citizens, so white people against people of color or just people against each other. In Africa, before but still nowadays, it's more of an international violence where a lot of the oppressors before were colonialist Europeans, but now, like you mentioned, it's more of an economical violence. So my question is, how can the dream, the I have a dream, be reached on a continent where the oppression comes from the outside? And it's not a problem to fix in the inside, if you know what I mean.
Very interesting. By the way, time is not our best ally. Could you please respond?
Yeah, I think you've touched on something that is very germane to the very future of the African continent, is that the violence continues. As I mentioned earlier, this time not so much state-sponsored violence, but violence from the economic community, violence from resource extractors, violence from people who want land, violence from people who just want the basic resources of the continent and excluding the people. But when I look at all of that, how do you address that? I think that the advocacy that needs to be done is to empower the people, to enlighten the people to rise up against these intruders. That needs to be done on the one hand, but also to hold the leaders accountable because they are the ones that open the door for the predators to come in. And very often with informed consent from the rulers. And so they come in and take as much as they want, leave the rulers with the pittance, well, and the people are gone.
Unfortunately, again, time is not our best ally. My thanks and gratitude to our guests, Professor Robert Vinson, Dr. Sherry Williams, Reverend Niedi Okule, and last but not least, Faustine Wawire. You've been watching and listening to VOA Special Edition of Straight Talk Africa, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Global Vision for Justice Live from the School of Communication at American University here in Washington, D.C. The moment for our television and radio audience, only we must end our broadcast, but you may switch with over to watch the remaining 30 minutes of